Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Lauren Wolf, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is the poet Christine Stroud. Christine Stroud is the editor-in-chief of Autumn House Press. She is the author of two chapbooks, The Buried Return, Finishing Line Press 2014, and Sister Sweet, Disorder Press 2017. And her poems have been published in numerous journals, including the Cimarron Review, Kestrel, and the Patterson Literary Review. Hi, Christine. Welcome to Prosody.
Thanks so much, Lauren. Thanks for having me.
Great. Can you begin by reading us some poems?
Yeah, definitely. I'm actually going to read a couple of poems, and this is the first time I'm reading them out loud, so we'll see how it goes. The Gemini. It would be a lie to say I always went to bed with one brother and woke up with another. That at night he placed pomegranate seeds on my belly, making constellations on my body, but by morning he was using my breasts as pincushions, little rubies of blood blossoming on my skin. But some nights the dimples disappeared from his eyes, and the pupils pooled over until there was nothing but dark swimming, until there was nothing but gasping and hands reaching for a surface that turned out to be glass. Occasionally, I turned my back to the good boy. Yes, I kicked the gravel around the driveway, smoked cigarettes until the black-eyed twin showed up, smelling of fetid lakes filled with swan feathers. Sometimes I wanted to hold hands with both boys, but that made the good pull at his hair, made the bad call me a slut. Some nights he laid his hand over my throat, and it was a wing of dissipating light. Other nights, he tightened until I panted, stop. But his roots grew into me until I was still. End of summer. The little boy on the sidewalk is dressed like a cop. A green visor eclipses the top of his face. A black vest hangs loose on his chest. He's dancing, takes two steps to the side, shakes his hips, and twirls his gun around his pointer finger. The scene makes no sense, like a bird being run over, a single feather twitching in the wind. Is this the Halloween costume that he demands to wear every day after school? Maybe the old man who watches from the porch bought it as a gift, placed the tiny folded outfit in his hands with a purpose so heavy the little boy understood its weight without asking. My ex used to wear a sweatshirt that said, "All cops are bastards," and we spray painted, "The only good cop is a dead cop," on the side of an abandoned building. This is what we believed. My new lover's son is a cop. He tells me his son is a good cop, and what he means by good is kind, incorruptible. This is what he believes. On the fridge, there's a picture of his son as a little boy with a bright blue Band-Aid on his knee. Because I trust his heart, I believe him. Because I don't think anyone's son is better off dead, I believe him. The leaves on the maples are yellowing. A little cop dances in the persimmon of the September sun. Because I'm at the diner alone, in this one-street town where no one will ever know me, I drink too much coffee, wipe hot sauce off on my jeans, because no one but the waitress looks at me, and even she forgets after the third refill. I stare down the row of red stools along the counter, stretch my arms straight and high above my head, and think maybe I'll just stay here. Here, where all I want is to be pregnant and have a landline. A sliding glass door that opens to a small cement patio and square after square of bright green sod. An unstained picnic table, a river birch with trembling leaves, sweat on my collarbone, a curtain lifting on the breeze. Here, where I can orbit into myself like a dog tamping down the tall grass before settling. Here, where the only tattoo I have is across the tips of my 10 fingers, a reminder, a prayer. Keep it slow. It is a viscous existence, a raw egg white life. For once, let me dream my life could be a slow conversation, a shadow changing shapes so imperceptibly I forget I am moving forward. For once, let me believe this could be my life, and that I'd ever, even for a moment, want it. Lotophagi. We eat the lotus flowers every morning near dawn, so when the thick, sweet paste of summer sunlight leaks through the dusty window, we are heavy with it. Our bodies, tacky, stick to the sheets. We forget about phone calls, day jobs. I memorize the pattern of freckles on your back. Our eyes won't open. They are dripping with burnt yellow tar. Late afternoon sweats. I like you best in lotus, honey. The Buried Return. Grandpa Robert, dead since 1994, moans and pounds on the door with the 2x4 nailed against the frame. I'm sorry I laughed at your funeral. I'm sorry I was 8. Grandma Dolores joins him, and they both beat the door in a slow staccato rhythm. I'm sorry I stopped visiting, Grandma, but you were always sleeping. You never opened your eyes. 2 rotting bags of maggots and flesh is not what I imagined when I prayed for a second chance. Jade breaks through the kitchen window. She groans and crawls across the linoleum through the shattered glass. I had a house full of rooms. I could have locked the shotgun and the bullets in the liquor cabinet, I say as I break her head open with the meat mallet. All I want is the poetry that drizzled like honey from her mouth, not dust, not dirt. The zombies surround me. Sunlight pushes through their decayed stomachs. They look like gilded saints.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Christine Stroud. Christine, what I'm really drawn to in your work, there's several things, but the imagery you create, particularly in that last piece, there was a little bit of violence and some subtle aggression. How do you work with that in particular?
I think that's always been a tension that's been in my writing, even when I started first writing poems. I think a lot of it had to do with the people I was reading. I was reading a lot of Sharon Olds and Richard Sykin at the time, and they also balance a lot of tenderness and love with some extreme violence. So I think it's something that I've always been drawn to, and it's something that I see a lot all of the time in the news, on the streets, things like that. So
do you feel like you draw a lot of your imagery from what you observe?
Yeah, definitely. I would say most of it.
In your daily life, do you keep notes of that mentally or?
Yeah, usually if I see something when I get home, I'm pretty quick to write it down. I don't immediately write the poem, though it sits around for a long time, typically while I think about what it means or mm-hmm. how I can use it in a poem.
So the first poem you read, The Gemini, could you talk a little bit about the inspiration for that piece and sort of the layers that you created in there?
Sure. I had been trying to write a poem about a really personal situation, a relationship that had ended, and I was having a lot of difficulty not making it just seem like a personal sort of journal entry. And then I went to hear another poet, Natalie Diaz, speak, and she was talking about writing her own book and about writing the difficult situation of her brother's addiction and that she had to sort of mythologize the situation. And so thinking about that helped me with the idea of bringing in the Gemini and the idea of the duality within people and, in particular, this lover and how to write about that situation.
That's interesting. Yeah, it's sometimes you have to take that sort of step backward.
Yeah, definitely.
And look at a piece from a different angle before it comes to fruition. So in that sense, do you feel like how many revisions does a piece go through with you?
A lot. Constantly. Probably even after this, I will go home and revise stuff. Even as I'm reading, I'll revise it.
Mm-hmm. So then what happens when it's published? Do you feel like it's done, or do you still have that obsessive need to change it?
I think it just depends. I mean, I'm always happy when I see it in print. I'm never like, oh, I wish I had changed that before they sent it off. But I might change it again.
It's like perpetually Leaves of Grass, right?
Yeah, totally.
Totally working on it forever. Can you read some more poems?
Yeah, definitely. I'm actually going to read a few from my chapbook that's going to come out next year, which is a collection of prose poems.
What's the title of that?
It's called Sister Sweet, and it's a collection of prose poems that deals with one central issue. Easter Sunday, 2010, tornado season. Do they not have the dogs anymore? Sister asks, nodding toward the neighbor's house. The morning is quiet without their yips, and she's uncomfortable, runs her fingertips over her eyebrow. The wind whips down the center of the street. She leans closer to me. I smell her cherry lip gloss. The neighbors divorced and moved a month after she left for college. I don't tell her the dogs are gone. Winter 2012, disappearing act. The police weren't sure if my sister committed suicide or if she was murdered. I saw her for the last time on Easter 2 years ago. 2 weeks later, her roommates found her hanging from the ceiling fan. It looked like suicide, but the medical examiner said she had had sex only a few hours before she died. She didn't have a boyfriend. No man came forward, so the police thought maybe it was murder. I couldn't decide what to believe, what was worse. New Year's, I get drunk and ask our friends if they think she killed herself because the sex was so bad. No one laughs. One girl cries, and Jeremiah's brown eyes muddy. He scolds, "It's too soon." But I am tired of everything being so sad. Perhaps for a moment it could be silly sad or screaming sad. Instead of a rain cloud, it could be white and fluffy, a cloud that looks like ice cream or maybe an atomic bomb. Late April 2010, a young priest at the funeral discusses sacrifice. He says something about letting go of what we love, something of trust, of lions and lambs. He calls me sister, says I will meet her again in the kingdom. I rub my palm over the smooth lip of the pew. In the parking lot, I stand alone staring at the late morning sky. A pink balloon is bouncing high on the wind. I should have tied your string around my wrist. On the way to the grave, I count the pines, row after row of long leaf. Too many, I lose count. Present day, daughter, sister. I tell my coworkers I am an only child. Linda, the HR woman, says, "My husband is an only two. He says it was never lonely, but I just can't believe it. Weren't you lonely?" I smile and shrug. Sure, sometimes. Before I moved east, I made a grave rubbing of her stone, charcoal pencil smudge, beloved daughter and sister. I packed all the pictures of her, of us, into a lavender shoebox, folded the rubbing in half. Beloved daughter facing out, and sister, like an afterthought underneath. In the bathroom mirror at work, I see what Linda sees. I have straight brown hair. I do not pluck my eyebrows. I am an only beloved daughter. At home, I drink cold white wine from an old pickle jar, eat an entire box of macaroni and cheese, one pot, bowl, fork, one empty bottle in the sink, little altar of loneliness. But sometimes I reach inside. I turn the page. Remember, I'm and sister still. August 1994, sex ed. "What sex?" she asks, her tongue pushing a hole through the center of her dull pink gum. I'm older, I tell her the pieces I know. A naked man lies on top of you and pinches your nipples. Her face creases. "But how can you breathe? Doesn't it hurt?" There are so many things I should have taught her along the way. How to put a condom on with your mouth. That trust is a coin jar and you have to put in a lot before it amounts to anything. I thought she was a virgin. After her baseball-playing boyfriend in high school forced his fingers into her shorts, there were no more boyfriends. But I never asked. I wish I told her that it could be good, nice, that certain summer afternoons you could lie in bed for hours, your stubbled legs draped over his hand a feather on your thigh. February 2014, just sister. Everyone around me nuzzles their faces into their jackets like small birds tucking beaks under dark wings. I shake, try to shrug winter away, switch the hand that holds the gas pump. We haven't settled into it yet. These frigid, snowless days are still a too tight sweater. We tug at the high neck and pull down the short cuffs. The wind blows. I smell watermelon. Drunk after a party, I curl at the end of her bed while she paints her fingernails with pink watermelon-scented nail polish. "Do you think boys never ask me out because I'm too masculine?" I ask. She shakes her head and smiles. You can't even open the pickle jar by yourself. Carefully, she leans over and paints my thumbnail a perfect pink chiclet. It had been cold then, too, but her room smelled warm with watermelon. This is the first time I remember you without your death as the first thought. You are my sister, who died. Helen, I say to the winter wind, and watermelon is everywhere.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Christine Stroud. So you mentioned that those were a collection of prose poems. So what do you think the difference is for you in working in a prose form as versus another type of form?
I think they're more narrative. I think it's easier for me. The idea of telling a continuous story feels easier. And I like how each one on the page looks like its own story.
Oh, yeah, it's sort of like a little paragraph. Do you feel that it frees you up a little bit or constricts you in other ways?
I think when I started this project, it felt more freeing to me. It was the first time that I really engaged on a multiple poem project, you know, where there was a theme that went on beyond just the initial poem. It was also the first time that I really pushed myself to write a lot of nonfiction in my poems rather than basing stuff on maybe real life events or things that I had seen. It was a new project for me, the whole thing.
Is that a struggle to work through a project, multiple poems?
It was actually kind of fun in a way. I guess maybe I could see why fiction writers like writing short stories or novels, because I was interested in these characters that I had created and I wasn't quite ready to leave them after the first two poems. So it was exciting. It was fun.
That's interesting. So several of the poems that you read from the forthcoming collection have dates in their titles.
Mm-hmm.
So what was sort of your strategy there, or your overall concept with doing something like that? 'Cause that seems really risky to me. That's kind of brave. To lay it out there like that.
Yeah, I think originally it was kind of to help me, because I wasn't writing them chronologically, but it helped me sort of space them and figure out. But I also sort of wanted to help the readers eventually kind of place when these things are happening, because it's, you know, it starts in the modern day, but then it moves back to when they're children together, and then it moves back forward. So I also was using it as a way to help place people.
Do you think that helped sort of too with the structuring of the collection? Like putting it together? Because when you're working with one theme like that, how do you organize a manuscript?
Yeah, I think it did help, because I didn't want it to just be, you know, from beginning mm-hmm. end, or, you know, to move backward through time. So I do think it helped me organize it, yes.
That's cool. So also another thing that I really like about your work is sort of this layering that goes on, these interesting juxtapositions that you make. How do you come to those? Where do you get that from?
I think that comes through revision. I mean, I think a lot of it is like pushing myself and wondering like how far I can take an image or an idea. And over the years, getting better at knowing when I've taken it too far and it doesn't make sense anymore. But I think that just comes through revision. So
when you revise, do you focus specifically on certain things like that? Do you revise for imagery or add in revision, or end up taking a lot away? I know each poem is individual.
Yeah, I think mostly I consider that I like overwrite, like I write way too much, and then I have to go back and take things away and fine tune it. It's like in the first draft, it's really getting the idea out there. And then when I go back, I can, you know, fine tune that idea, take back maybe some of the unnecessary images, clarify, mm-hmm. strengthen the images.
Yeah. And that's interesting, because I tend to underwrite, and then when I revise, I have to add stuff. So it just depends, right?
Yeah,
everybody's
definitely
a little different, which is interesting. Do you revise for sound? Because you have such rich, lush sounds in your work, great alliteration and assonance going on. Is that sort of something you focus on, or does that happen when you're drafting? I'm sure sometimes it does.
Yeah, I think sometimes it happens naturally, but I do usually early on start reading the poems out loud to sort of hear how they sound. It also helps me with just like the pacing of mm-hmm. it as well. Like if it's going on for too long, or I need a stanza break or something like that.
That's cool. Yeah, I like the sounds in your work.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Can you read some more work?
Yeah, definitely. His poem. Right now, one of our roommates is listening to death metal, and I hate it. The light in your room is on, and I hate that too. Because I'm drunk and lying on my hardwood floor, wondering what poem you'd write about this every day we've saturated ourselves in, our breakup. I used to write poems in the dark while you slept, only waking if a snore caught thick in your throat. But even then, you were only half awake for a moment and then gone again. How many times I stopped from whispering your name, bringing the laptop to bed and asking, does this sound all right? Does this image make sense? I wanted you to read everything, but your poem, I don't want to read it. Let me see it. Let me hold that piece of paper, pizza box, book you wrote it on. Let me see the landscape all scrawled out in your heavy hand. Are there metaphors that stretch like the highway in Nevada we thought we'd die on when the snow blocked out the night? Would your lines be long and thin like a row of longleaf pine? Would it be wide and open? Would it be Kansas, the state we hated driving through most? We were tired. We gave the open sky, a windmill, and the grass fields the middle finger. We were giggles and fever, your hand on my thigh, my naked feet on the dashboard. It's been almost 4 years. You've moved out. I wrote two lines about loving you. It was a Sunday afternoon, darling, sweet and yellow glazed and curling in the sunlight. Marcescence, or everything I don't know about enlightenment. The vacuum quiet of an empty forest, snow-clad and bright. Beech leaves quiver on the crisp wind. I stare at the depressed knot of an oak. I can't understand. Is it another empty gnarl, or is there a small brown owl tucked into the opening? My eyes water under the concentration, needing desperately to know. I stand too long. The cold grows through me, aching my fingers and toes. All winter, I strive to be the holler, the bird calls bouncing between the hills, echoing but not permeating. I look for God, not that unknowable God, but the God of my youth, a large hand dropping, soft and harmless from above. I search for signs in the branches. I wait for animals to cross my path. I make a mantra. This is mine, and I can let it go. This is mine, and I can let it go. Somewhere in me, the brown leaves cling to their branches. They tremble, and this is mine to keep. My last evening in Ho Chi Minh City. From the air-conditioned bus, I watch a family on a motorbike laced between the swarm of cars and rickshaws. Father, brother, little sister wedged between, so small in her hot pink t-shirt, tiny, shoeless feet. Wind tangles her fine, dark hair. She tries to tuck it back with a green plastic hairband. Over and over, unable to capture every black strand. Her brother takes it from her hand, slides it over her hair, behind her ears. One quick, smooth movement. I do wish there was a way I could save this for them, a way that each time they begin to bicker over a last piece of sticky red candy, for every time he pulls in annoyance that dark, straight hair, for when she steals the silver coins from his dresser. When they are years away from this, her alone in a quiet room, perhaps him in his first apartment in some foreign city high above the loud and teeming streets. I want to say, look, this. Once someone's hands knew you better than your own, someone needed to lean their delicate weight into you, and you let them. The summer I cleaned pools and listened to The Great Gatsby on audio tape. Honestly, I didn't clean them at all. Rather, I smoked cigarettes. In the shade, sweated out a hangover, listened to Tim Robbins read. Before leaving, I picked slick oak leaves from the cool surface and checked the filters for dead animals. Frogs, maybe a mole, once a small green garter snake, his body coiling and essing in the bubbling water. I dumped the bloated bodies, which looked just like a dog's chewed plastic toy, over the white fence. Didn't bother to bury them. What scavenger would touch them? Their decay disrupted by all that chlorine, which made the death so much more unfair. I had no place in that bright blue water or in the surrounding houses with scalloped curtains wooden shutters that never creaked on their hinges. Still, on the terribly hot days, I'd slide into the water, float on my back, t-shirt ballooning around me. Some summers we are irredeemable. We sleep in our clothes and drink too much. We fall in love with unlovable characters. I held my breath, flexed my muscles, pretended to be a long, lean snake.
That's great stuff. Those poems feel a lot different than the prose poems that you read. Can you talk a little bit about that? Is this a different sort of project?
Yeah, some of those were also a little bit older, which might have something to do with it. And I think, again, they're lineated poems. They're kind of coming from a different spirit, I think. Some of them are also based on a job that I, in fact, had and did not clean the swimming pool. So it's also maybe reflecting on a younger time. Mm-hmm. So maybe it carries that voice.
So how do you come up with your titles?
I usually do that after the fact. Coming back to it, sometimes I can't decide, like on the Marcescence or mm-hmm. Everything I Didn't Know About Enlightenment. I'm still trying to figure out which one of those I want to use.
That's a good title, just how it is.
Okay, well, maybe I'll keep it. Thanks.
But I mean, do you find the title somewhere buried in all that clutter that you clean out, or does it pop into your head? For me, sometimes when I'm writing, I can't start if I don't have a title.
Which yeah.
I think is strange.
Sometimes that happens. Actually, the Everything I Didn't Know About Enlightenment, that title was suggested as a prompt to me to get me to write a poem. And then as I was thinking about it, I had also been thinking a lot about Marcescence, which is like when a living organism holds onto a dead organism for no reason, really, like when trees hold on to dead leaves. So I was thinking about my issue with enlightenment and how, you know, that letting go. So I think that title did drive the poem more than some of the others. But his poem, I mean, I just couldn't think of a different name. That's really what it was.
So earlier you talked a little bit about how it's important for your poems to have tension.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you're conscious of as you're building a poem, or you're looking for that specifically?
I think I'm looking for it. I think it's something that I just notice. I think it's like what interests me in life or in conversations. And I think when I'm reading, I'm interested in that and how that pushes people forward, and like our need to find resolution sometimes in those tense moments, but how sometimes there isn't. And we just have to accept it and live in that moment, I guess.
Can you read a little bit more?
Yeah, definitely. I might read a little bit more from my old chapbook. It's actually the first one in the book. I threw your shoes in the river, and I am not sorry. I was sorry to get caught and sorrier to lose a month's allowance, but I stood at the end of the pier and watched your day glow orange flip-flops float down the white oak until they were nothing but a burnt smear on the water.
The poetry of Christine Stroud. Thank you so much for being here, Christine.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's been great.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 FM.